Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West, from the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Adele, reading Delilah of the Snows by Harold Benlon. Chapter 14, The Necessary Incentive. While Ingleby and Sewell made their way back to their tent, Esmond sat thoughtfully in his comfortless room at the outpost, cigar in hand. He felt distinctly pleased with his astuteness, but he was by no means sure what use he would make of the information Ingleby had somewhat unwisely supplied him. Esmond was merely a capable police officer with certain defects in his character, and not a clever scoundrel. In fact, he had his good points, or he would not have retrieved his credit in a service which demands a good deal from those who would rise in it after becoming involved in difficulties in England. But he was arrogant, vindictive, and apt to be carried away by his passions. He disliked Ingleby, and would in any circumstances have found it difficult to forgive the miner for having twice caused him to appear at disadvantage. While the fact that Grace Colthurst had shown Ingleby some degree of favor was an almost worse offense, Esmond had the prejudices that occasionally characterize men of his station, and it seemed to him distinctly unfitting that the gold commissioner's daughter should patronize, as he expressed it, a placer miner. He was not exactly in love with her, though he had once come near being so, but he cherished a tenderness for her, which might in favorable circumstances have ripened. The circumstances were not, however, favorable, for there was a certain stain on his reputation, which he fancied Major Colthurst, at least, remembered. It was therefore pleasant to feel that he held the whip over the presumptuous miner, and could apply it when advisable, though he had in the meanwhile no very definite purpose of doing so. It was not his business to see that Major Colthurst carried out the mining laws, and in any case, Ingleby had found no gold that would render the sequestration of his claim a matter of much moment, besides which Esmond reflected that it would be considerably more congenial to humiliate him openly in person, instead of inflicting a malicious injury on him by the hand of another man. An opportunity would no doubt be forthcoming, and he could afford to wait. With this commendable decision, he flung his cigar away and went to bed. However, he became a little less sure that reticence was advisable when he saw that Ingleby and Sewell visited the gold commissioner every now and then, and it happened, somewhat unfortunately, that he dismounted to take up a stirrup leather when riding back to his outpost through the canyon one evening. Save for the hoarse roar of the river, the tremendous hollow was very still, and the sound of voices came faintly up to him. Turning sharply, he made out two figures among the pines, and an expletive rose to his lips as he recognized them. One was a miner in miry long boots and soil-stained jean, the other a girl in a light dress. Esmond's eyes grew a trifle vindictive as he watched them, and though he had one foot in the stirrup, he did not obey the impulse that prompted him to swing himself to the saddle and ride away. Instead, he led the horse behind a wide-girth cedar and stood still with a trace of darker color in his face. It was unfortunate that he did not know Grace had met Ingleby by accident, and that he could not hear their conversation when he stopped for a few minutes by the edge of the river. "You've not been near us for a while," said the girl. I've been busy, though I am not sure that is a very good excuse, said Ingleby. Besides, one feels a little diffident in the circumstances about presuming too much on Major Colthurst's kindness. Grace laughed, though she understood the qualification. I am, of course, not going to press you, but come when you wish. The Major, if one might mention it, rather approves of you. And when he and Mr. Sewell play chess, there's nobody to talk to me. Ingleby, who had sense enough to take this admission for what it was worth, looked thoughtful. Sewell, he asked, has been there without me? Once or twice. Then he certainly never mentioned it to me. Does he give you an account of everything he does? And Grace laughed. How is your work at the mine progressing? Slowly. In fact, considering our appliances, we have had almost overwhelming difficulties to contend with. Still, one could hardly expect you to be interested in them. I am, however, and there was a faint but subtle suggestion of sympathy in the girl's voice that sent a thrill through him. It cost him an effort to hold himself in hand, but Ingleby had been taught restraint in Canada, one sign of which was that he seldom inflicted his opinions on other people. He had decided that it would be time to let his aspirations become apparent when he had found the gold and made himself a position. It never occurred to him that the girl was probably quite aware of them already. It was not an easy thing to hide them, and though he was growing accustomed to the discipline, the topic she had suggested was a safe one. Well, he said, the gold we expect to strike lies in what was presumably an ancient riverbed, though there is, strange to say, very little of it in the Green River now. It was probably deposited there thousands of years ago, and it is evident that we have struck only the outer edge of the patch of sand and gravel containing it. We tried tunneling, but twice the soil came in and nearly buried Ledger, and at Tomlinson's advice we sank another shaft. All the work had to be done again, and we often go on half the night now. It is, I think, only a question if we can hold out long enough, for winter is coming. Still, it must be done. He had not proposed to indulge in more than a very matter-of-fact narration, and had in one respect certainly not exceeded this, but there was a curious ring in his voice. And Grace understood his thoughts as she flashed a swift glance at him. His face, which was a trifle haggard, had grown intent, and the little glint in his eyes had its meaning. Grace Colthurst recognized, as Hetty Ledger had done some time earlier, that Ingleby was toiling harder than was wise. She also knew, as well as if he had told her, what purpose animated him. Still, she had no intention of admitting it just then. I think, she said, you should be careful not to do too much, and if you were going back to work tonight, you must come no farther. Ingleby protested, but Grace was resolute, and turning left him standing in the trail. She walked homewards thoughtfully, with a faint trace of color in her face, for the man's unexpressed devotion had stirred her. Then, in a somewhat unfortunate moment, she looked up and saw Esmond waiting beside the trail for her. A glance at his face sufficed to show her that he was quite aware she had not come there alone, and roused in her a curious sense of antagonism. It had become evident to her already that he bore no particular goodwill toward Ingleby. The view is really worth even your attention, she said. Esmond knew what the suggestion of hardness in her tone meant and smiled as he glanced down in the froth-smeared river toward the tremendous rift in the rocks through which it thundered. Beyond it, the mists were streaming across the deep valley and crawling filmily athwart the pines that climbed in serried battalions towards the gleaming snow. It is, in fact, I scarcely think I could improve on it. But it was not the view that kept me here, he said, No, and Grace's voice was a trifle harder still. Esmond looked at her steadily. I had, he said, the pleasure of seeing you coming down the canyon a little while ago. His meaning was very plain, but he had given her an opportunity, for Grace had noticed that the cedar he stood near was great of girth, and the undergrowth was trampled at one side of it. The man winced as she moved forward a little and glanced at it. I suppose, she asked with quiet contempt, that was why you thought it necessary to lead your horse off the trail. Esmond, who had not expected affairs to take this turn, fumed inwardly. He was not quite sure why he had stayed there at all, but his indignation had become possessed by a vague and very senseless notion that a friendly remonstrance might be admissible, and at least afford him an opportunity for expressing his opinion of Ingleby. He was, of course, by no means a clever man and angry at the time, or he would never have made that mistake. But his purpose was not altogether a base or selfish one. Grace Coldhurst, who was of his own station, must, he felt, be guarded against herself, and since there was apparently nobody else available, he undertook the task. He became vindictive, however, when he realized that it would be difficult to carry out his commendable purpose. I think we need not go into that, he said. Perhaps I did wrong, but it would only lead us away from the topic I want to talk about. Has it occurred to you that unless you put a stop to his presumption, that minor fellow might get ideas into his head? Grace appreciated his courage in persisting, especially in view of the result of her previous thrust. But while she was not exactly sure of her sentiments towards Ingleby, he was at least the man who loved her, which counted a good deal in his favor. Esmond, she was quite aware, chiefly loved himself. Isn't that a trifle vague? What ideas do you mean? She asked. Esmond stood silent a moment or two, for his task was becoming unpleasantly difficult, but his bitterness against Ingleby rashly determined him to go on. I should prefer not to be more definite, and I'm not sure that it is necessary, he said. Still, one might perhaps venture to warn you that the miners and my troopers, who of course have eyes, have already found an entertaining topic. Grace Coldhurst's face grew a trifle colorless with anger, though she did not quite believe him. So, you can listen while your policemen discuss me, she said. No, said Esmond unguardedly. I would have risked my commission by thrashing the man I heard mention you. A sardonic gleam crept into Grace's eyes. Then, since you haven't done it, it is a little difficult to understand how you could be aware of what they are saying. The man's embarrassment was evident, but it lasted only a moment, and he made a little abrupt gesture. I'm no match for you at this game, Grace, he said. Of course, I'm taking a great liberty, but if you think a little, you might find some excuse for me. For playing the spy on me? Esmond's lips set tight, and the bronze in his cheeks took on a still deeper tinge, but there was, as is usually the case, good as well as evil in him. And he was to some extent endeavoring just then to discharge what he considered a duty. I suppose I deserve it, and I am in your hands, but you can be angry with me afterwards if you will let me speak. We are old friends, and I feel that implies a certain responsibility. There is nobody else in this country except the major who would concern himself about you, and he, with all due respect to him, seldom sees beyond his nose. There was a suggestion of genuine solicitude in his voice now, but Grace was, unfortunately, far from being conciliated. And you possess the faculty of seeing very much farther? Esmond made a little deprecatory gesture. In this case, at least, you see, I know the presumption of those half-trained fellows of Ingleby's description, and I would like to save you the unpleasantness I think you were courting. There are times when one has to be candid. The fellow is quite capable of fancying you are in love with him. He stopped, for there was a red spot of anger in Great Colthurst's cheek, which was otherwise curiously colorless. I think, she said incisively, you had better change the topic. You have gone quite far enough. Esmond gazed at her with evident appreciation. She had never seemed so alluring to him as she did just then, while she stood very straight in front of him, quivering a little with ill-suppressed anger. In fact, he felt very far from sure that he was not in love with her. Still, he persisted. It would have been less preposterous had he been a man with any education or nicety of feeling, but you have even to take his antecedents on trust, and a good many of the men here have a somewhat astonishing history. Grace stopped him with a little imperious gesture. I have heard enough, she said. In fact, a good deal more than I shall probably ever forgive you. Besides, it was scarcely advisable of you to allude to other people's antecedents. One would have fancied that you had a better memory. Esmond closed one of his hands, for he had almost hoped that Grace had not heard of the little discreditable affair in England. The contempt in her face made the fact that he had deceived himself unpleasantly plain. I scarcely think that it is quite what one would have expected from you, he said. A little charity is always advisable, and you may find it indispensable. He swung himself into the saddle, and Grace went on alone, well content that he had gone, but nevertheless wondering whether she had ventured too far on Ingleby's behalf, for she realized that the rejoinder which had closed the discussion was not altogether excusable. She did not care to ask herself why Esmond's insinuation should have stirred her to an indignation that was stronger than her sense of what was fitting. Esmond rode back to the outpost furious, and since he could not retaliate on the girl, decided to seize the first opportunity for injuring the man. And he had reasons for believing that one would shortly be offered him. It is, however, probable that he would never have profited by it, had not the girl stung him to vindictive passion. It was, though she was not aware of it, by no means a kindness Grace Colthurst had done Ingleby. Join me next time on the Sagebrush Trail for more Western adventure in Delilah of the Snows by Harold Binlaw.